One similarity between Venezuela and Syria was the economic warfare waged against them by the West. The Syrian government fell in part because the US-EU Caesar sanctions had devastated the economy. Syria could not get access to hard currency and thus had very high inflation. The major difference, the Western-sponsored war on Syria, which began in 2011, the Syrian state was significantly weakened by more than a decade of war.
The U.S. has a reserve of oil in their own country for another 6 to 7 years. U.S. is now having a situation where in the very short term, they're going to have scarcity of oil. Right now, they don't have any other sources of oil like they used to have in the past, except purchasing the oil at the international markets the way they are cost today. And what they're trying to do in recovering the oil fields of Venezuela, which by the way have the largest oil reserve in the world, okay? Venezuela is the country with the largest oil reserve in the world. What they're trying to do is to have access to oil resources at a cheaper price.
Welcome back. This is the InfoNews section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is the U.S. hunger. Explainer, why millions sleep on an empty stomach in the U.S., the wealthiest country on earth? On October the 31st, former U.S. President Barack Obama highlighted an issue that is largely overlooked by legacy media but widely debated inside the country. More than 47 million Americans, including 1 in 5 children, don't have reliable, affordable access to nutritious food. And as the cost of living skyrockets, more families are depending on SNAP benefits or food stamps to put food on the table, he wrote in a post on X. The next item is the EU economy. EU blames economic woes on Donald Trump, but forgets who broke the machine. Brussels is preparing to cut growth forecasts for 2026, hinting already that Trump's tariffs and trade uncertainty are dragging Europe down. A neat explanation, especially for a crisis that the EU will spend years engineering with its own hands. The same EU that proudly cut itself off from cheap Russian energy. The next item is cashing in on the Gaza genocide. Gaza war bonanza. How U.S. giants cashed in big on Israel's genocide. Donald Trump is currently seeking congressional approval of a $6.4 billion package of U.S. weapons sales to Israel, including $3.8 billion in Boeing Apache attack helicopters and $1.9 billion for 3,200 to 3,250 infantry assault vehicles. West Coast giants like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon also signed deals to provide cloud computing, AI infrastructure, and data services to the Israeli military. Cloud deals can be worth tens of millions per year per contract. Our next item is oil sales to Israel. According to a report by Oil Change International, 25 countries were responsible for shipping vast amounts of oil to Israel during its two-year Gaza offensive. Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Russia, and the U.S. were among the largest suppliers of oil. More than 21 million tons of crude oil and refined fuels, including jet fuel used by military aircraft. Welcome back. This is the in-depth section of the program. The U.S. wants to eliminate the drug trafficking cartels in Venezuela, or at least that is the facade that the U.S. wants other nations to believe. The U.S., in fact, wants Nicolas Maduro gone. This reasoning is slammed internationally and also by the Latin American countries. Why? You ask, it's because they don't want the same fate happening to them. During the time that President Hugo Chavez was in charge of Venezuela, economically speaking, there were many strides made under his socialist system. Let's look at this graph, for example. The unemployment rate in 1999 was 14.5%. It almost halved to 7.6% in 2009. The next item is GDP per capita. In 1999, it was $4,105, while in 2011, it was $10,000, more than $10,000, the currency. Let's look at this graph as well. And the inflation, the average consumer prices back in 1999 was 23.6%. In 2012, it was 31.6%. The next item that we are going to have is the extreme poverty rate. In 1999, it was 23.4%, but in 2011, it was 8.5% under Hugo Chavez. And the final one that we are going to have right here is oil exports, the nominal net rates. In 1999, it was $14.4 billion, while in 2011, $60 billion in revenue. The next item is a snapshot of the major sectors of the economy, which dates back to over a decade ago. It's interesting that oil exports back in 2008 were over $43 billion to have been reduced to $8.62 billion. The U.S. sanctions on the country were a major factor in low GDP per capita, of course, confidence in the government, and of course, inflation, which exploded to unprecedented levels, as you can see. Now, let's bring in our guest, Professor Peter Kuznick, Director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Professor, is the U.S. flexing muscles against Venezuela to project power over Latin American countries, that if they don't follow the U.S. foreign policy here, they are going to suffer the same fate?
The U.S. is sending a message to all of Latin America, and as it's been sending to the rest of the world. When Trump talked at the beginning about invading Panama, invading Canada, invading Greenland, we saw who he is and what he represents. He said he wants the Nobel Peace Prize and deserves it. I'm the person who nominated last year's winner for the Nobel Peace Prize, the Japanese anti-nuclear group, survivor group, Nihon Hidankyo. I was part of their delegation in Oslo. The only prize that Trump deserves is the biggest warmonger, biggest fascist enabler on the planet right now.
Now, this graph right here shows the extent that the U.S. sanctions affected the Venezuelan economy. In 1999, $334 billion was the GDP of Venezuela, and during Maduro's time, it was reduced down to $68,216,000, a result of harsh U.S. sanctions which cut off Venezuela from the world financial system. The next item looks at the year 2008. Things started to improve for Maduro and his government, and here are the improvements seen in different sectors as reflected in the GDP, which is a drastic improvement compared to figures just a couple of years ago. The economic indicators here shows the improvements. Notice GDP coming in at positive 3%, with inflation caught dramatically, quite an improvement from what it was previously. The economy's rebound was due to adjusting to sanctions, domestic production, and help from countries like Russia, Iran, and China. And repairing oil infrastructure allowed oil production to rise above 1 million barrels per day, bringing in more hard currency. One of the lesser known facts is that the U.S. has, throughout its history, attacked sovereign Latin American countries on many occasions, over 50 times. and wanting regime change or coups to lead to regime change. That is why many of the Latin American countries are against the U.S. warmongering policies, in this case, against Venezuela. Now let's bring in our other guest, Roman Grossvogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, can it be concluded that Donald Trump is after the oil and gas, not only for economic benefits for the U.S., but to be able to control the oil market against countries like in Latin America who are not subservient to the U.S. demands?
USA is trying to destroy the Bolivarian government, and they want to, which is right now the wall that is putting obstacles for the U.S. to have full control over the governments and the economy of the region. Right now, they are in an offensive to destroy all the governments that used to have some kind of sovereignty and claims against U.S. empire. For example, the Correa government in Ecuador was destroyed. The Kirchner's and Fernandez government in Argentina was destroyed. Now the Bolivia government was also, this has been destroyed recently. And now the main country left right now with wealth resources is Venezuela.
As of November the 23rd, the U.S. has announced a new phase of military aggression against Venezuela, with so many U.S. officials saying that the U.S. is very much prepared for a new round of actions against Venezuela. By the time this program is aired, the U.S. may have launched an attack on Venezuela. The U.S. pressure to oust Maduro from power appears to be a definitive goal. Why, with a military buildup in the Caribbean underway for months and Trump to have authorized covert CIA operations, it may be just a matter of time before there is an invasion or targeting of sites inside Venezuela. I'm Kyarash Bunamati, and I'll see you next week.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند، ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on results and outcomes of the uprising of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The Master of Martyrs, together with his kin and disciples, were all massacred, but they advanced their ideology. The school did not face defeat, rather it made progress, that is, it defeated the Bani Umayyad forever. The Master of the Martyrs gave his life but save Islam, the religion that Bani Umayyad caliphs meant to pervert. God saints to suffer defeat. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, lost a war to a caliph. It goes without saying Imam Hussein was defeated in the war with Yazid and got killed, but in reality he was victorious. The defeat of these men was superficial. Their victory was real.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio about Muharram and the Ashura Imam Khomeini رحمة الله عليه said breast beating in the morning processions must make sense as well this viewpoint of Imam Khomeini رحمة الله عليه is about the authenticity and moderation in the morning gatherings for Imam Al-Hussein عليه السلام We should always be aware of the important points that if these gatherings are held in a way such that they spread superstition and false ideas and to serve to weaken people's beliefs and make our thoughtful and wise generation heedless to such gatherings, that is definitely opposed to Imam Hussein's ideal and also to Islamic values. The ceremonies held to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam should be apart from the enthusiasm and love for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, gatherings for understanding the realities of the religion and religious teachings. If an eulogist or a narrator narrates the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he must make sure that what he narrates is authentic, historically documented and appropriate of the position of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He must use the best and the most beautiful language, for example, poem to describe the historical realities and the calamities which Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam, his family, children, and devout friends suffered. One should not relate stories that are not authenticated, nor should he tell anything that is incompatible with Islamic concepts in the name of teachings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or in the name of his love. The love which is valuable in Islam is the love which is based on wisdom and reason. That is the red love which in fact enlightens the human intelligence. It is the love which should in reality manifest the reality of the religion and represent the public faith and belief. We must not preach anything which is opposed to the religion, history and reason. We should not spread false ideas in society in the name of love or Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam or in the name of belief in Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. And that is a very important point that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi referred and mentioned in this regard. Thank you very much for listening to us. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode of Spring Up the Truth. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Sometimes it's better to be up your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside. Use it in the right way.
Let's start with this unrecognized and, to me, bizarre, you can probably shed some light on it, meeting back in July between Jonathan Pollard and Mike Huckabee. Huckabee is, of course, the Zionist U.S. ambassador to Israel. Pollard is the notorious theft of American national security secrets. Is Pollard a hero to the Israelis?
Well, he is, and he's a settler who is sort of a local celebrity among the religious nationalist world. I remember there's this bookstore I used to walk by in central Jerusalem where a lot of settlers would frequent when they came into Jerusalem to go shopping and so on, buy frozen yogurt. And it had a giant picture of Jonathan Pollard over the front door because at that time he was considered cause célèbre to the religious nationalist movement and kind of a political prisoner in Israel. And that was the main bookstore where settlers could get messianic texts and so forth. So he's a hero to a certain constituency in Israel. And through the Adelson bribery network, Miriam and Sheldon Adelson, Donald Trump was basically paid to release him. He was sentenced to life in prison. Jonathan Pollard was sentenced to life in prison for some of the most damaging intelligence thefts in U.S. history. He was a naval intelligence analyst. He did this for ideological reasons because he believed he was an Israel firster. And he handed over the methods that the NSA used to collect intelligence to the Mossad, as well as a list of thousands of intelligence contacts, collaborators, undercover spies, the knock list that U.S. intelligence used to Tel Aviv. He did this in exchange for money, but for ideological reasons. Ultimately, Donald Trump released him, and Sheldon Adelson flew him back to Israel on his personal jet, where he is now sort of a hero. And for some reason, Mike Huckabee last July, what I call the Israeli-U.S. reciprocal ambassador, decided to meet with Jonathan Pollard in his office. And this came as news to me, but it also came as news to the White House and to the CIA. None of them knew about this. And this should be a fireable offense, considering what Pollard did to the United States. I mean, this is Aldrich Ames level spying. This is treachery. He is a traitor. What was Huckabee doing with him? No U.S. ambassador has previously met with him, but it does appear that Huckabee has ideological kinship with Jonathan Pollard. Huckabee is a Pollardite, and if Huckabee isn't fired for this, we have to ask, in what world, in what political movement, in what White House does he not get fired? It's one that believes in MEGA, making Israel great again.
Well, it wasn't on his schedule, and the press knew nothing about it. I didn't know about it until you told us a little while ago, and then I looked it up, and it just came out, I guess, in the past few days. So Huckabee must have known he needed to keep this secret from the CIA, from other embassy employees, and from the White House. I bet he didn't keep it secret from Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, he didn't keep it secret from other figures in the Trump administration, because it looks like they went to the New York Times. Three current senior officials confirmed this to the New York Times. So it looks like this is an internal problem. And it's something that I've been seeing from inside the Trump administration. There are still forces in the Trump administration that are deeply uncomfortable with the personnel in control of the policy, because they consider themselves to be Israel firsters, or as one Trump administration source called them to me, Mossad stenographers.
You know, Mike Huckabee, and I know him well, Max, because he was full-time at Fox for about 2 or 3 years during the much longer time that I was there, but I didn't know now what I now know about him.
Yeah,
he is what Tucker Carlson is being excoriated for condemning, a Christian nationalist who puts Israel above the United States, an arch Zionist. Now, I don't know how a human being nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, the official government representative of another country, can put that other country first and expect to get away with it.
Well, all the other previous U.S. ambassadors that I can think of were Israel firsters, even under Joe Biden. Tom Nides, for example. I mean, after October 7th, he went and lobbied on behalf of the Jewish federations for more money to support Israel during its genocide. Before that, you know, under Obama, Daniel Shapiro, he stayed in Israel with his family when his term ended, and went on to lobby for the NSO group, which produces Pegasus spyware. You had David Friedman, from the first Trump ambassador to Israel. This is a figure who has a part-time residence, I think, in the settlement of Beit El, is part of the Friends of Beit El, raises money for the illegal settlements from the U.S., is a complete Israel firster. I mean, he wakes up in the morning, maybe eats some cereal, and then lobbies for Israel. That's what he does with his life. But what Huckabee has done here is an act of just such naked treason, or to associate and welcome and as someone who betrayed the United States at such a high level, that I don't understand how Trump can protect him anymore, unless Trump is that fully invested himself in the Israel First program, or that this would be just too embarrassing for him. It's really Trump at this point. He has to choose between Adelson and the CIA.
Well, how does Huckabee explain this to the White House now, which I he must have done by now, since the time the New York Times piece appeared?
It was like Pollard was like crashing some party, or he broke in somehow. I don't know. I don't understand what the excuse would be.
Let's talk about another Israel firster who happens to be the United States ambassador to the UN. Why were Danny Dannon, that thug that is the Israeli ambassador to the UN, and Mike Waltz embracing each other on the floor of the Security Council earlier this week?
Yeah, a really tragic moment in the history of the UN as the Gaza Master Plan passed. And this is a plan to essentially internationalize the occupation of Gaza and a Trojan horse for permanent Israeli control and a colonial program that I can explain in a little bit more detail in a minute, but which was approved, voted for by the one Arab state on the Security Council in a non-permanent role, Algeria, and the one Muslim state in a non-permanent role, Pakistan. Two countries that had feigned concern for Gaza for the last 2 years. And then behind them you have Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, you know, the so-called the Arabs and the Muslim states that are vying for a role as part of this international stabilization force, which is really a pacification force whose mission will be to disarm Palestinian resistance factions and put Palestinians at the mercy of the Israeli army, but behind an international flag. Now, Turkey has said that disarming Hamas without ending the occupation would be a red line. So why do they want to be involved in this? Have they spoken out against this resolution? Now you have the two permanent members that would normally veto such a thing, Russia and China. They both abstained. Russia's abstention, I think, will be as consequential, if not more, than its abstention on the vote to declare Libya a no-fly zone, which was part of what convinced Putin to run for president again, because that was during the time of Medvedev. This, what explains the Russian and Chinese votes, given that they harshly condemned the resolution and offered the same analysis that I just did, that it's a Trojan horse for reoccupation, that it will violate international law and so forth. They claim that they couldn't abstain, they couldn't actually veto it when you have all of the Arab states, which are basically vassals, being in favor of this international force. And after they vetoed it, you have the Palestinian Authority, the Vichy Authority that collaborates with Israel to rule the West Bank, supporting this vote. So what you've seen is the complete betrayal of Gaza by the Arab and Muslim world, and Russia and China failing to step in because I guess they don't want to complicate their relations with Turkey and Egypt and all these other mid-level powers. And Gaza is now at the mercy of what Jared Kushner called the master plan, which I can explain, but which is essentially a colonial divide and conquer plan that continues the genocide under international cover.
And will this master plan permit Jared Kushner to become the development for the very valuable waterfront real estate?
I should actually clarify, it was Steve Witkoff who referred to it as a master plan in a 60 Minutes interview, and Jared Kushner was seated beside him, and he grimaced with so much agony because Witkoff had let the cat out of the bag.
Didn't the vice president let the cat out of the bag in a similar environment where he referred to Kushner as the investor?
Yeah. I mean, Kushner is the investor in a company that has proposed Gaza seafront real estate. Kushner has himself referred to Gaza as ideal waterfront real estate property. So absolutely, Kushner is interested in the master plan. If you look at the map right now, there's this yellow line that Israel has set up preventing Palestinians from reaching the arable areas that used to be agricultural land. It cuts them off from everywhere east of Gaza City all the way down to east of Khan Yunis. Rafah is completely destroyed in the south, so there's this giant buffer, and Israel's occupying that as well as the Netzarim corridor. And that yellow line confines the population of Gaza into basically a concentration camp where Israel and the United States military, through its new Civil Military Coordination Center in the Israeli city of Kiryat Gat, control all the access points for aid. They're dumping cell phones into Gaza today. There are images of tons of cell phones being offloaded into Gaza for obvious reasons, spying and spreading destabilization. Then what Israel's going to do is in those areas where they're carrying out demolitions, where Palestinians are not allowed to go, where they're being killed if they go, outside the yellow line, which is 58% of the Gaza Strip, they're going to create these so-called model cities. We've seen the maps for them in the Boston Consulting Group plans, and they're really like gated communities where everything will be digitized. Like the nightmare that everyone who opposed the COVID lockdowns had of 20-minute cities and globalist control, it will be fulfilled there. Everyone will be living in these biometric gated communities. Businesses will be blacklisted that do not comply with Israel, and those that are whitelisted will be run by future warlords. And the United Arab Emirates will be one of the Arab authorities administering things financially, but cash will be virtually this will be sort of a cashless society. Everything will be digitized and tokenized, biometric. Everyone will be under mass surveillance. And then anyone who remains back in the areas that were controlled by resistance factions, Palestinian grassroots factions, they will be subjected to more starvation sieges and continuous bombardment unless they move to the model areas. That's the future of the master plan until they get those areas on the waterfront for Jared Kushner and his buddies.
Gee, I wonder who will build the digital infrastructure. Probably the same people that threw you out. Palantir, probably the same people that threw you out of that conference where you tried to question them.
Well, Palantir has been heavily involved by the admission of its CEO, Alex Karp, who was just at the U.S.-Saudi Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center down the street. 2 days ago, Alex Karp has boasted about his role in providing Israel with targeting assistance through Palantir's Maven system and participating openly in the genocide. And in the Boston Consulting Group plans for the so-called master plan, various multinational corporations, tech corporations, were put forward for contracts, Oracle, Amazon, Palantir being just among a few of those that control our media in the United States and our administration.
Wow. I want to get to Venezuela and the CIA's cocaine business with you because you've just done some extraordinary reporting on it. But before we do, I'd like you to watch this clip from John Kiriakou.
The reason, though, I'm told, that Donald Trump decided to bomb Iran was that the Israelis said for the first time, if you don't bomb Iran to take out these deep bunkers, we're going to use nuclear weapons. And they had never threatened that before. And so Trump said, bombing Iran might actually save us from the start of World War III if it keeps the Israelis from using nuclear weapons.
So according to your source, the Israelis told the President of the United States that if he did not use the United States military power to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran, Israel, acting on its own, would use nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Do you see why there's a problem with that statement, John?
Yeah.
Because they've never admitted that they've had them.
That's right.
So you're telling me that they just admitted to the President of the United States that they have nuclear weapons and we still do not have them in the IAEA treaty.
I mean, if Israeli nuclear whistleblowers are to be believed, yeah, they've had them. They started working on them in the 50s. They got them around the late 60s or the early 70s. Look at Mordechai Vanunu. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't charged for treason for nothing.
Is this credible, Max?
It is. Jonathan Pollard, remember I mentioned him before, we talked about him before, the Israeli spy who was in U.S. Naval Intelligence.
Right.
He gave an interview fairly recently to a fellow settler on a podcast in Israel. And he said that back in 1973, we were on the ropes. And when he says we, even though he was in the U.S., he's referring to the Israelis. The Egyptians had broken across the Sinai and were marching towards Israel proper. The Syrians were attacking from the north. And they wanted Nixon to resupply them with an emergency airlift to save Israel. And so the Israelis took U.S. officials to an airfield, showed them an A-4 jet packed with nuclear weapons, and said, if you do not authorize the emergency airlift, we will use nuclear weapons. And so Pollard is openly boasting about nuclear blackmail carried out by Israel back in 1973. That's what John Kiriakou is referring to. That's Israel's ace card. It's what Seymour Hersh called the Samson option. And the program was exposed by Mordechai Vanunu, one of the bravest whistleblowers in history who was tortured for decades by Israel for what he did. He was a former worker at the Dimona facility.
Wow. Does the CIA traffic in cocaine.
Well, I referred to them in a debate 2 days ago on Piers Morgan with the former U.S. Ambassador James Story and a former CIA agent who was sort of made famous by Joe Rogan, Mike Baker. I referred to them as the cocaine import agency. The CIA was directly responsible for creating the so-called Cartel of the Suns that is now said to be under the control of Nicolas Maduro, was just named last week by Marco Rubio a narco-terrorist organization to justify striking Venezuela on land, possibly assassinating its leadership. And it's a completely fake construct that was created by the CIA in the early 90s to ship 22 tons of cocaine into the U.S. Now, why would they do that? They thought that this would allow them to surveil the drug running networks through the United States, identify who's selling the drugs, but they wound up poisoning our society, as Marco Rubio claims. And this was just sort of, this is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the CIA being involved with cartels. The DEA agent who actually realized that the CIA was involved with the Guadalajara cartel in the 1980s and was using the cash to fund black operations run by Ali North in Central America was named Kiki Camarena. And what happened to him? He was tortured for days, tortured to death by Guadalajara cartel members in the presence of Felix Rodriguez, the notorious CIA agent who back in the early 60s presided over the execution of Che Guevara. This is all pretty well documented stuff. But then we have figures in U.S. federal prisons like Genaro Garcia Luna, who was the most powerful law enforcement security official in Mexico for years under the administrations of Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderon. These are like the two key U.S. allies from the PAN and pre-parties, from the PAN party in Mexico. And the U.S. knew about this. State Department officials knew that Garcia Luna was colluding with the Sinaloa cartel to ship massive amounts of cocaine and fentanyl into the United States. But they continued to, they turned a blind eye to it because they had this Plan Merida with Calderon and Vicente Fox. They called him the George W. Bush of Mexico. The U.S. loved him. He was like the most pro-U.S. Mexican president. They turned a blind eye to it until it became too late, and now Garcia Luna is in a supermax prison in the U.S., sentenced to life. I mean, this is like the head of the FBI being involved directly with the cartel. I don't know what Cash Patel's up to, but I don't know if he's gone that far.
Wow. Is the CIA plotting a coup in Venezuela?
Well, Elliot Abrams seems to think they are because he's Gargamel has just resurfaced in the pages of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, the veteran coup plotter who presided over the El Mozote massacre in El Salvador during the dirty wars of the 80s, who oversaw coup plots in the Gaza Strip against Hamas, who presided over previous coups in Venezuela, all of which failed. And he's now putting forward a plan for a special forces, U.S. special forces attack on Venezuela. So the CIA, I mean, Trump has authorized them to operate in a lethal fashion, essentially overtly in Venezuela. A refinery, petrochemical refinery, just exploded yesterday in a key energy producing region of Venezuela. I mean, we can put two and two together, but it's pretty rare, if not, it's very rare for a president to announce that the CIA is going to carry out covert activity. It's a psyop that Trump is deploying in order to promote fear and instability among the Venezuelan leadership in hopes that there will be mass defections among generals. But Abrams is now the most senior voice to openly support special forces attacks inside Venezuela. There's another figure named Marshall Billingsley. If you're watching this, go to his Twitter account if you want to see war-crazed, maniacal psychosis in action. He's just tweeting photos of hospitals, high-rise buildings in Caracas, a baseball stadium, fantasizing about U.S. Tomahawk strikes on these structures and essentially claiming that this is where Maduro's bunkers are or the vice president's bunker. But these are political officials of a UN-recognized government, and he's calling for Israeli-style strikes on hospitals. Marshall Billingsley has worked in administration since the George W. Bush era, was testifying in Congress last October, was Trump's key guy on sanctions on Venezuela. So this is not some nobody, and this is where their thinking is going. There's only one person who can stop this crazy train, and it's Donald Trump, and I don't know if he has it in him.
He's the engineer of the train. Before we go, from Elon Musk.
You know, people often talk about sort of eliminating poverty and that kind of thing, but really how long have they been talking about that? There's lots of talk, there's lots of NGOs sort of trying to do these things, but really not succeeding. And you know, the evidence speaks for itself. But AI and humanoid robots will actually eliminate poverty. And Tesla won't be the only one that makes them. I think Tesla will pioneer this, but there will be many other companies that make humanoid robots. But there is only basically one way to make everyone wealthy, and that is AI and robotics.
What the hell is he talking about? AI and robotics are going to make everybody wealthy and eliminate poverty. You get it?
Well, they're going to make everyone unemployed, and then everyone's going to have to live off universal basic income as the man seated to Elon Musk's left, Jensen Huang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, said right after Elon Musk. What Elon Musk is saying makes absolutely no sense. And it shows that in the world of AI and tech, there is a messianic mentality that is being fueled by massive infusions of cash that is leading to nowhere. They talk about all the energy they need, all the gigawatts they need, but they don't exactly know what they need it for. They don't have a clear budget. Elon Musk has gotten his board of directors to approve a $1 trillion pay package for himself. Where's the money going to come from? And they're at the Saudi U.S. Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center, which was a grotesque gallery of corporate looters and Saudi monarchs and their lobbyists and Donald Trump, a real portrait of American governance at a late and decadent stage. And the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is actually not as flush with cash as we think it is, has failed on several white elephant projects like Project NEOM, which was to align Saudi Arabia's coasts with resorts and high-speed rail and is going absolutely nowhere, has ponied up $600 billion for these AI warlords, these messianic figures, including Elon Musk, who are seeking more and more cash so they can say that that their earnings have gone up, even though they're not actually selling a product that is profitable at this point. Saudi Arabia generates about $1 trillion every year. So it doesn't have $600 billion to give to them. I don't know where the money is going to come from. This was just the strangest spectacle of financial fantasy. And essentially what we're witnessing is a kind of Ponzi scheme in which all of this money is being directed into AI, our money, Saudi money, but it's not coming back. It's not necessarily creating jobs. It's causing consumers to pay more for electricity bills through all these data centers. And it's fueling a bubble, much like the dot-com bubble of the 1990s. And if you look at NVIDIA's earnings, you have all of these investors with short positions on NVIDIA right now. NVIDIA's taking in all this money, but it's not actually generating anything. It looks like the bubble could burst and do irreparable harm to the U.S. economy. And we're going to go back and look at that scene there of Elon Musk predicting the end of poverty and gather up our pitchforks.
You mean Donald Trump's sons will not get to build Trump Towers in Saudi Arabia?
I don't know what they're building, but they're props to Eric Trump and his crypto business, which has taken in $1 billion of completely opaque bribes for the Trump family from often foreign governments and foreign figures. We'll never know who they are. That was impressive.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Greetings once again, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's what's waiting for you next on your radio station. We'll bringing you the very latest updates. It's time for our news segment this hour. Stay informed with the top headlines and breaking stories from around the world. After this, prepare for profound insights with Minbar. In this program, we present selected excerpts from the speeches of the renowned Islamic scholars, covering a wide range of topics including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and at times, social and political issues. Minbar brings the voices of the pulpit to life, timeless words that inspire thought, faith, and action. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. We sincerely hope you enjoy it. Finally, we present leaders' speech. Listen to English translations of the selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on various occasions, a concluding moment of guidance and reflection. Up next is news this hour. Stay tuned.
Allah, 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 Allah,
Ya Rabbi,
Allah, Allah,
Ya Rabbi,
Allah, Allah, Allah. In the night they will stand and cry in hope and in fear. Nothing in the world can ever turn their hearts away from the calm of surrender they find when they say, Allah, 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 Allah. se tere aur shab ki ronak zulfon se
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran says the United States has become the greatest threat to international peace and security through threatening or using force against the world countries. The Israeli military intensifies its attacks across the besieged Gaza Strip, carrying out artillery and airstrikes in multiple areas despite the declared ceasefire. And search and rescue operations get underway in three Southeast Asia nations as floods and cyclonic storms leave over 900 dead and hundreds missing across the region. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story: Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the United States, through its recent actions across the world, has become the greatest threat to international peace and security.
The United States, through